Hey everyone, welcome to Vassals of Kingsgrave's Agatha Christie linear reread. My name is Bina 007 and I'll be your host today alongside Pat.
Hi, 2.0 in the Discord, back again.
Wonderful. And we are back again for episode 48, which is Dead Man's Folly, originally published in October 1956. Starring Ariadne Oliver and Hercule Poirot. So we've decided to make this a main pod, Pat, for the first time in a while, and I was surprised at how much I enjoyed this book. Was this a first read for you or a reread, and how did you get on with it?
Yes, this is the first time reading it for me, but I had heard the John Moffat radio play, which was very good. I enjoyed this as well, and I think quite interesting because it contrasts with a lot of this. You can, like, I suppose it's to be expected when you've got somebody who's written more than 70 books, you're going to find different things in each book that you're going to like. And I thought this was quite interesting because this is probably one of the few where I feel that the mystery is the real strength rather than the characterization.
Yeah, agree. It's beautifully crafted. But it's also, I think, the setting. There's just something about it that I think is really compelling. It is famously set in a country house called Nass House, which is based like for like with Agatha Christie's summer house Greenway in Devon, where she spent every summer when she made her money. And if you watch the David Suchet ITV adaptation of this, it's actually shot at Greenway. So you can see it in the place it was shot, a bit like Dead Man's Folly, a bit like Five Little Pigs, which is set in a version of Greenway. So I think that also attracts people to it. But I think it's a really lovely book. Okay, so let's get into it. The one previous to this was Hickory Dickory Dock, published in November 55, which was also a Poirot. So we've got a little bit of a run of Poirots. And we have some nice Christie-verse stuff in here, not just set in Greenway, but a minor film star opens the country fate, which will be explored further in The Mirror Cracked. But to hook people in who haven't read this, and I must admit, I'm reading this off the Wikipedia summary. This is the kind of the plot concept. Hercule Poirot is invited to Nass House in Devon by crime mystery writer Ariadne Oliver, who is staging a murder hunt as part of a summer fete the next day. At Nass House, Mrs. Oliver explains that small aspects of her plans for the murder hunt have been changed by requests from people in the house rather deviously until a real murder would not surprise her. So famously, Ariadne Oliver believes in feminine intuition and she's called Hercule Poirot down because she's got this bad feeling, a bit Scooby-Doo. She's got a bad feeling about this, that someone's going to get murdered. And the murder mystery hunt takes place and the teenage girl who is playing the murder victim, Marlene, ends up being murdered for real in the boathouse. Any comments on all of that, on the plot hook?
No, as I said, I don't think you can talk a great deal about the characterization because I think a lot of these are sort of stereotypes that Christie has used before. But I do think there's some like interesting points with the Ariadne Oliver character. I think there's like a couple of meta comments where you can see that Christie's making comments about being an author.
Yes.
You know, she has that great bit later on where she's saying, well, if you know anything about writers, you'll know they can't stand suggestions. People say splendid, but wouldn't it be better if so-and-so did so-and-so? Or wouldn't it be wonderful if the victim was A instead of B, or the murderer turned out to be D instead of E? And I mean, one wants to say, all right, then write it yourself if you want it that way. So I think Christie's used it as an opportunity to get back at some of her friends who've probably been making suggestions to her. I did think the conversation between Poirot and Ariadne Oliver, where you mentioned the feminine intuition, was quite sweet because I, whether this is true or not, I believe this myself. I believe like we label things as intuition, but really what it is it's the vast sum of our experiences and our brain has processed it on a subconscious level.
Agreed.
We just can't articulate it. And you sort of like, you lead into it. And Poirot actually, he compliments her. He said, look, like you're a very clever woman. You've got a lot of experience and you think a lot about these things. Just because you can't logically explain it, it doesn't mean that on a subconscious level, you don't understand what's happening here. So, you know, Poirot becomes equally concerned.
Yeah. And he rarely respects people, right? So it's...
Yes.
If he holds her in high regard, so should we. There's a really great true crime podcast called Real Crime Profile, which is run by a real-life New Scotland Yard behavioural psychologist, a behavioural analyst, and one from the FBI. Mm. And the one from New Scotland Yard, who's a woman, often talks because she's a specialist in coercive control, And she talks a lot about women having to, or, you know, victims of abuse should trust their gut instinct. Mm. Like, your gut instinct is there for a reason. And as you say, it's probably linking things in your subconscious mind that are real. And you should trust it. If your intuition is that you're in danger, then you should get out of there, because most of the time it will be borne out. Yeah. And without, like, descending into paranoia. So absolutely, I'm with you there on Ariadne Oliver. This is, of course, a novel of the mid-50s, so we haven't had a full pod for a while, and social change is afoot. I was thinking to myself, I wonder if summer fates really happen anymore in big country houses, or maybe I just don't move in those circles. But there's a lot of social change going on. There's the first mention of a Scotland Yard photographic unit and fingerprints, which I thought was quite interesting. So we're getting, you know, CSI Agatha Christie. There's the first explicit mention of casual sex in the woods and cars and, you know, people having sex in cars, and the first mention of rape and paedophilia in one of her novels. So there's a sense in which Agatha Christie is becoming more graphic in her kind of almost nonchalant description of what goes on.
Yeah, but I mean, one of the things I wanted to comment on was just that there's that bit, and I think they do it quite well in the adaptation as well, where Poirot comments on the bare legs of one of the tourists.
Yeah.
You know, and he's shocked by this exposure of flesh. So I do think there is the nod to the increasingly more permissive society.
Yeah, you know, we're on the cusp of the 60s, and Papa Poirot is slightly shocked by these backpacking girls in tight little shorts. And it's all going horribly wrong. And of course, next to Nas House is another country house that's been turned into a backpacker's hostel, which was very much part of the setup at Greenway. The next door house was a hostel. I mean, Agatha Christie did get errant backpackers running across her land. Times are changing. There's a lovely kind of way in which Agatha Christie sums this up when she describes breakfast. And you've got to think that she started off with Mysterious Affair at Styles, which would have had a very traditional country house breakfast, like in Downton Abbey with all the hot dishes on the side. And here's the quotation. Poirot came down to breakfast on the following morning at 9:30. I mean, 9:30. Hilarious. Breakfast was served in pre-war fashion, a row of hot dishes on an electric heater. Sir George was eating a full-sized Englishman's breakfast of scrambled eggs, bacon and kidneys. Mrs. Oliver and Miss Brewis had a modified version of the same, probably not with kidneys. Michael Wayman was eating a plateful of cold ham. So I just thought that was really sweet, this idea that the hot, lavish country house breakfast is seen as an anachronism now.
Yeah. Yeah, something that they're sort of like hankering after. You know, it's done in pre-war style. There's almost an element of nostalgia there in that for Christie.
Maybe even playing the role of running a big house, like you feel socially obliged to do it. All right, let's get into the events. So since Hickory Dickory Dock, published on October 55. So November 55, official start date of the Vietnam War. December 55, in Montgomery, Alabama, Rosa Parks refuses to obey bus driver James F. Blake's order that she give up her seat to make room for a white passenger, and is arrested, leading to the Montgomery bus boycott. Also, the debut of Dame Edna Everage, one for the English and Australian.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. It's like a long time ago, right?
Yeah, Barry Humphries, what a legend. Sadly missed.
Yeah, on stage in Melbourne. I mean, and actually like a really literary man, right?
Incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. General Motors becomes the first American corporation to make a profit of over $1 billion in 1 year. Ugh, time was. February 1956, British spies Guy Burgess and Donald MacLean resurface in the Soviet Union after being missing for 5 years, something that will be relevant to one of the characters in this book. June 1956, General Electric Telecron introduces the Model 7H241 with the snooze alarm, the first ever snooze alarm clock.
And millions of people were late for work as a result.
I know. There's nothing more annoying than a snooze alarm, because it's like annoying being woken up and then you're just going to repeat that annoyance for 15 minutes.
But we still reach for it. We still reach for it.
Absolutely. And playwright Arthur Miller appears before the House Un-American Activities Committee in DC. So again, we're in the McCarthy era, right? And sort of the kind of communist paranoia. Rightly so, if you look at Burgess and MacLean showing up in the Soviet Union. July 1956, John McCarthy, Marvin Minsky, Claude Shannon and Nathaniel Rochester from Dartmouth, MIT, Bell Labs and IBM respectively assemble the first coordinated research meeting on the topic of artificial intelligence. And however many years later, 70 odd years later, here we are with ChatGPT. Okay, and then Egyptian President Nasser nationalizes the Suez Canal, which is going to precipitate the Suez crisis in the UK in particular. September 1953, the hard disk drive is invented by an IBM team. I was quite surprised it was that old, but I suppose in those days, hard disks were probably like the size of my house, right? I mean, it's not floppy disks, is it?
Probably had something the size of like an aircraft hangar, and it just, what you've got in a USB stick, it probably had like a fraction of what you can store there now, the way things have moved.
And October 56, last but not least, Cecil B. DeMille's epic film, The Ten Commandments, starring Charlton Heston as Moses, is released, and it will be one of the highest grossing films of all time, adjusted for inflation to this day. The United Kingdom and France begin bombing Egypt to force the reopening of the Suez Canal. Pro tip, that's not going to go well. And the Hungarian Revolution breaks out against the pro-Soviet government. Originating as a student demonstration in Budapest, Hungary attempts to leave the Warsaw Pact. And again, that's not going to, much more tragically, that's not going to end well either. But
no.
So we can see this is like a time of great technological process, but also Cold War at its height, communist paranoia and the civil rights protests kicking off. So
yeah, what a momentous year. Like, listening to all those things, I'd never twigged. I mean, I'm aware of all those events, but...
So they all happen at the same time.
Yeah.
I know, it's nuts, isn't it? It's really nuts. And you can sort of see why, in a way, a sort of a pleasingly constrained country house murder might actually be quite a sort of...
A comfortable read.
Yeah, a warm blanket of a read. Because as much as some of those real life things impinge on it, fundamentally, it's quite a constrained set of problems to be solved. All right, so let's get into the characters of this novel. Let's start off with our beloved Hercule Poirot, the Belgian detective. Any Xander Lord Baron honorary zingers to mention?
Yes, he had a great conversation with Alec Legg later on in the book. And he actually contradicts himself. He's surprisingly modest when he first bumps into Mr. Legg. He said, "I am not often wrong, and it exasperates me." But then moments later, he says to Alec Legg, Alec Legg says, "What the hell business is it of yours?" Because Poirot is probing into his private life. And Poirot replies, "None, but I am always right."
This is another quote between Alec Legg and Poirot, probably the same conversation, where he says, "It is, you know," Poirot persisted, "a form of humility. And humility is valuable." There was a slogan that was written up in your Underground Railways here, I remember, during the war. "It all depends on you." It was composed, I think, by some eminent divine, but in my opinion, it was a dangerous and undesirable doctrine, for it is not true. Everything does not depend on, say, Mrs. Blank of Little Blank in the Marsh. Papa Poirot is absolutely finest. And yes, as you said, lots of Poirot being, you know, very, I mean, arguably misogynistic, but he doesn't like unpretty women being naked. So here's another one. "He was reflecting, not for the first time, that seen from the back, shorts were becoming to very few of the female sex." He shut his eyes in pain. Yeah. "Why, oh why, must young women array themselves thus? Those scarlet thighs were singularly unattractive." I can't help but thinking that that was probably Agatha Christie's rather old-fashioned. She's probably self-mocking herself a little bit there too.
There is an element of that with this book. I do think like the mystery is its strongest element, but I think some of the reviews at the time were saying like it's a bit tired, and I do feel like it has lost a bit of the sharpness that she had in the 30s, when you felt that she was making much more sort of socially provocative statements, you know, whereas this is. But I think that's possibly, you're right in what you were saying about this almost being a reflection of the times, you know, living under the threat of nuclear war. We have this massive ideological clash between communism and capitalism. And, you know, these hot conflicts in proxy countries going on in the background. You know, so I think there probably is an element of wanting to write something that is set in very familiar settings, you know, rather than pushing these boundaries that, you know, were going on in other places.
Yeah, I think that's probably very fair. So let's move on to Ariadne Oliver. You already spoke wonderfully about her character and how intelligent she truly is. Any other good Ariadne Oliver lines in there that you noticed?
No, unfortunately, there are a few. I was quite pleased that she gets as much time as she does, because I do think she's quite a fun character.
Yeah, I agree.
But I've not got anything else apart from...
It's why I like it, because I think it's more balanced in a way between the two of them. Like, she's not a sideshow. Like, she truly, they truly are equals investigating, which is lovely. There's a lovely little one where I think it's Mrs. Oliver as Agatha Christie, where she's talking about having been invited to give a talk on how I write my books. And she just finds it absolutely frightful. Quote, I mean, what can you say about how you write books? What I mean is, first you've got to think of something. When you've thought of it, you've got to force yourself to sit down and write it. That's all. It would have taken me just 3 minutes to explain that. And then the talk would have ended and everyone would have been very fed up. I can't imagine why everyone is always so keen for authors to talk about writing. I should have thought it was an author's business to write, not talk. So I thought that was just absolutely hilarious.
Yeah.
Okay. And then let's move into Nat's house, which is where this summer fete is taking place. It's owned by a chap called Sir George Stubbs. He has a big beard. He adopts the naval style. Apparently he was in some sort of naval stuff during the wars, made money, obviously. Mrs. Oliver describes him as rich and plebeian and frightfully stupid outside business, I should think. But probably dead sharp in it.
I've got like quick thoughts on all the characters, but as I said, I think the characterization in this is not as rich. I mean, I was thinking like this book contrasts quite interestingly with something like The Hollow.
Yeah.
You know, where The Hollow is so fantastically characterized, and yet you found the sort of the mystery a bit flat. Whereas this one has got like a fantastic mystery. But the characterization is flat. So.
Yeah, I agree. It's been going through this very quickly. I agree.
Yeah. I mean, I've just got down here, comes across as a bit of a blowhard, you know.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah. And like at one point, his wife is shushing him, saying, oh, don't start on the communists. Like, I think he's just basically one of those, you know, sort of Tory bores, basically. And then he's married to Hattie Lady Stubbs. And she's a bit interesting, actually, because everyone refers to her as literally simple-minded, like she's mentally deficient. Mm. She's meant to have grown up on a sugar plantation in the West Indies and then was schooled in a convent in France when her family were killed in a fire. And then Mrs. Folliot, who's the prior owner of Nat's house, sort of brought her up as a ward and arranged her marriage to the apparently very rich Sir George Stubbs. So... she's quite, she reminded me a little bit of Jane Eyre when you have the character who's raised in the West Indies and no one really knows what's wrong with her. But apparently she's incredibly beautiful. So this is how Mrs. Oliver describes her. And there's Lady Stubbs Hattie, about 20 years younger than he is, rather beautiful, but dumb as a fish. In fact, I think she's definitely half-witted. And then she's made up really weirdly, like she has this sort of very white skin, bright red lips, lots of mascara. And then she has a habit of wearing these pointed hats, like the Dior New Look, which are called politically incorrectly coolie hats. So she's very sort of theatrically made up, basically.
Mm.
Any thoughts on Hattie?
No, not really. Just again, she's a character that we've seen before, you know, very beautiful. I think the one thing that comes out, and it was quite an interesting dynamic, is her obsession with jewellery.
Mm.
You know, she ought to have lots and lots of jewellery, you know, so not anything.
She reminded me a little bit of the younger wife in Crooked House. He just sort of sits purring like a cat and likes nice things and just not really much more to her than that. Staying at the house is Michael Wayman, an architect, and he's young. He's designing a tennis pavilion for Sir George and repairing the folly. So the dead man's folly of the title, a folly being a sort of like small pavilion that's usually perched on a hill or a viewpoint in a big estate garden. But in this case, he thinks it's been built in a slightly bizarre place. And he seems to be quite snobbish about what he's being asked to do by these nouveau rich people.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what Michael Wayman says of George Stubbs. Who does he think he is? Stuck himself into some cushy admiralty job in the safe depths of Wales during the war and grows a beard to suggest he saw active naval service on convoy duty. I think we're meant to understand that they've got no class, really.
Well, yeah, it's supposed to come across like that, but I've not got a great deal of time for Mr. Wayman anyway, the architect. I mean, I know he's an important character. He's quite clearly a lech, You know, he is chasing at least two women around.
He's on the make, isn't he?
Yeah, definitely. So
young man on the make. And then also staying at the house, we've got Mr. Wilfred Masterton, the local MP, and his wife, Mrs. Connie Masterton, who is actually the one who suggested having the fete at the house. So when Ariadne Oliver's talking about being sort of gently prodded into changing her plans. And this is, I think this is so brilliant. I feel that Agatha Christie has met this woman. Quote, Mrs. Masterson was a somewhat monumental woman who reminded Poirot faintly of a bloodhound. She had a full underhung jaw and large, mournful, slightly bloodshot eyes. She bowed and resumed her discourse in a deep voice, which again made Poirot think of a bloodhound's baying note.
Yeah, super savage.
And then we have Captain Jim Warburton, who's the political agent for Mr. Masterton. So that's just the person who... They still exist, don't they, the political agents? I think they're the people who sort of arrange the elections and interlocute with your local Tory party committee. Perhaps more interestingly, we have another couple staying there, Alec Legg and Sally Legg, his wife. Alec Legg is an atomic physicist, and I think that's sort of kind of interesting because, you know, we've had these... Well, I mean, you know, Destination Unknown features atomic physicists who were sort of doing a flit, a bit like our Cambridge spies over to the other side. And that's the kind of, I guess that's the implication or the suspicion here. But he's a really savage guy. Like, this is him. This is what he thinks of life. I should like to see every feeble-minded person put out, right out. Don't let them breed. If for one generation, only the intelligent were allowed to breed, think what the result would be.
I'm almost certain that Mr. Legg wouldn't make it because he's a complete wet blanket in this. And again... Like, here we are, we described his wife, Sally, seems far more impressive character, far sharper, and is also supposed to be very beautiful. And you're left wondering, what does she see in this guy again?
I know.
You know, like you've pointed out, he's quite a nasty, narrow-minded character, you know.
Leave him and go off with the gardener or something.
Yeah, definitely. So, but again, it's a career, isn't it? The atomic physicist. We had this as well in Crooked House.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
You know.
This is this age of science, the new Elizabethan age. Mm. And also staying in the house, last but not least, we've got Amanda Brew as his George's secretary. But we know from Agatha Christie that these secretaries can often be obsessive and in love and all sorts of craziness ensues. Yes.
And I do think the Amanda Brewer's character was quite interesting in this as well. So I do like her as a character in this.
Yeah, sort of these kind of professional women Agatha writes are always pretty compelling.
Yeah, it's a stereotype because she's used her before, but I think that this is one of the better ones, I think.
So. Yeah, I agree. And then sort of living outside of the house but on the grounds is Amy Folliat, whose family previously owned Nass House. Her husband died pre-war, two sons in the war, apparently. She lives in the lodge. So she's kind of lost her social position, right, because her family had been there, I think we're meant to understand, for centuries and centuries and centuries.
Yeah, and she's one of these women or part of this gentrified class that have been basically wiped out by the taxation system because of the death duties. Yeah. Of basically forced her to sell Nass House, and it's like she's been struck by three sets of death duties because, like, her husband's died, and then her eldest son's died, and then her youngest son has died, and each time, the estate has passed to a son, and there's been death duties on it, so it's just been decimated, really. So yeah,
but I mean, I think Agatha Christie does have some sympathy for her as a victim of high taxation, but. You know, then there's the, I love the country characters, the village characters. So there's Myrtle, the 92-year-old boatman. He's like, there's always been a Folliat at Nass House. Yep. So he's like the sort of, he's almost like something out of, what's that Alfred Hitchcock? Daphne du Maurier, Rebecca. Like these sort of slightly gothic, sort of, you know, weird old retainers who sort of mutter spooky shit on their way. And then he's got, as it so happens, a granddaughter called Marlene Tucker, who is the person who's playing the dead body. And she's got quite a lurid imagination. She's probably me at that age, actually.
Yeah, I thought she came across as a really tragic character. I think, although all the other characters are quite snippy about her, you know, they're quite nasty. Again, I think there's this bit where it comes back to looks. They talk about, you know, her not being a pretty girl and things like that. And, you know, you're reading about her and they're almost dismissive of the things that she's interested in because she's interested in makeup and what other boys and girls are doing in magazines. And you're thinking, like, there's no great crime here. She's not. Like, she comes across as quite a sympathetic character. And when you talk about how these books have changed or how society has changed around these books, I think she's maybe somebody who we would have more sympathy for now than maybe society would have had back when it was first written. I don't know. But I like thinking about this sort of change, this society change. So.
Yeah, she's a proper young teenager, isn't it? She loves makeup and magazines, and she's not a character you could have imagined 20 years ago. And, you know, Agatha Christie did have young teenage girls, as in Evil Under the Sun, for example. But the character there is very different to Marlene. Marlene's very modern. She's a girl guide. We've seen Agatha Christie use girl guides before in Body in the Library. But I love how, I mean, this is what Agatha Christie at this point is in her mid-60s, and she seems very in touch with a new generation of, you know, because Marlene's intelligent and she's got a will, like she's active, she's not passive.
Yes.
And I think she is quite compelling. And like you say, I think she does, I was sad when she died. I think she's got something about her. I like, she's desperate for something to happen, isn't she? When she's just like, any sex maniacs, asked Marlene with avidity. Yeah. I like sex maniacs, reading about them, I mean. And I just think, you know, me on my psycho, sicko, serial killer thread on Discord, I mean, it's like, I just thought, she's just a poor girl who wants a bit of fun, but she's smart, you know, there's something to her.
Yeah, she's somebody who's outgrowing the village that she's being raised in. You know, she wants to see a bigger world.
Yeah, so. And she'll never get that chance. And it's sad. We have of the various people at the fete, we've got backpackers. We meet a couple of them, the Irish one, the Italian one. And then we've got, last but not least, Etienne de Souza.
Sorry, you've got to mention, she was Dutch because I love the comedy accent in the Suchet adaptation.
Yeah, she's Dutch. And there's also the guy with the turtle shirt. So there's a few of these.
Yeah.
These characters flitting around.
Yeah, and but sorry, you weren't mentioning Etienne de Souza.
Yeah, so. Lady Stubbs' cousin. So she was raised in the West Indies. I think it's implied that he hasn't seen her for years and years, but he knows she's grown into a very beautiful young woman. Mm-hmm. And he's coming on his yacht, and I think he's meant to be very glamorous and very rich. He doesn't need to stay in the house because he's got a luxury yacht.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I've got down here. Enigmatic foreign rich man. That's my summary of him.
And just as he comes, Lady Hattie Stubbs disappears. So people are wondering, is she another murder victim? What's happened? And the twin, the murder of Marlene and the disappearance of Hattie Stubbs at this country fete are really what prompts the investigation. So a lot of it is, you know, Poirot trying to figure out who said what to whom, where, when were they in the palm reading tent? When were they in the tea tent? And what's actually happened. So we'll kind of leave it there to be spoiler free. Anything else you want to talk about?
They mentioned this on the All About Agatha podcast, where they were talking about the way this novel had developed and how it had developed out of a novella. And I do think that you can see it does seem to be quite thin, you know, and it is, you do get the feeling that some of it has been padded. And I'd say that is maybe a downside of this book. And it's maybe why I maybe wouldn't rank it as highly as I would rank some others, even though it's got this great mystery element to it. I wouldn't call this top tier, but it would be very, very top of middle tier, because of the strength of the mystery. You know, it's not got the same level of characterization as her earlier better books.
Yeah, I agree, but I just think it's one of the better plotted of the weaker ones. Yeah. Like compared to some of the ones I've read in the 50s, like this is by far like a better read. Okay, let's quickly do whether it's progressive or regressive. And I'm afraid, apart from like depicting a very lovely young teenager who's smart and feisty, it's pretty, there are some questionable things. We just discussed the hats, but I guess that would have just been a phrase for those hats at the time. There's a lot of really questionable stuff about West Indies people, and that Hattie looks South American. They use the phrase half caste, which I don't know. I'm not sure we're meant to be using that phrase anymore.
No, I don't think so. I don't think it's stood the test of time. For the best.
And the idea that all the people on those islands have been intermarried. I mean, it's just really, really pejorative. So Hattie comes in, just the way they depict her mental condition and also her race is really dodgy. And then there's a lot of dodgy stuff relative to sort of Mr. and Mrs. Tucker. I think there's a lot of looking down on the Tucker family as working class and Marlene, sort of, you know, there's a lot of, I don't know, this idea that, you know, oh, anyway.
It's maybe, this contrasts well with earlier Christies, because the thing is, this is a Christie where the working classes are portrayed in much more depth. And so that we do get that class snobbery. It is more sharply in focus because we are focusing more on these characters, whereas they might have just been like comic relief with an aside before, you know, back in the 30s. We didn't get to see these characters in any sort of depth, whereas now we do.
And they are seen as quite parochial, aren't they? Like Mrs. Tucker. So when she's told her daughter's been killed, this is the quote, she broke down suddenly and began to sob. "If you ask me," she said, "it's one of them nasty foreigners up at the hostel. You never know where you are with foreigners. Nice spoken as most of them are. Some of the shirts they wear you wouldn't believe. Shirts with girls on them, with these bikinis as they call them. And all of them sunning themselves here and there with no shirts at all on. It leads to trouble, that's what I say." Which, you know, maybe that's an accurate depiction of attitudes at the time, but it, you know, your daughter's been murdered and you decide to go on an anti-foreigner rant. And then most explicitly, Sir George uses the D word about Etienne, which is horrible. We haven't had that for a while. I think it was used back in Hercule Poirot's Christmas. So
it's very difficult to know how much, like, we don't approve of the use of this language in a modern setting, but I do think there is something in what you said in previous podcasts about Agatha using stereotypes, cultural stereotypes that would have been familiar in society at the time, to throw us off track. And I do think, he doesn't come across as a sympathetic character, Lord Stubbs. I'm not a big fan of his.
Yeah, he's a Tory ball, right? So I think it says more about him than anything else, right? Exactly. Or even the times. It's just him being, you know, he's gone on foreign, anti-communist rant. So he's just, I think in a way she's showing up what it is to be small-minded, but it's a shame she did that to Mrs. Tucker. punching down a little bit there. Yeah. Agatha Christie. Now, here's an interesting one, because you've heard the All About Agatha podcast episode and I just listened to it before this. And they talk about a lot of language used about the dead Marlene, where they're getting into, you know, was she sexually interfered with? And I don't remember reading that in my book. Do you think that's been taken out of my modern edition? Or, because I feel like I would have made a note of it as being really awkward. But do you remember that?
I think what I found with the All About Agatha podcast is that they are just more sensitive to certain readings of it than I am. I think it's there to be read into the book. I didn't get it myself when I read the book.
Yeah, it's like not in the text, is it? Or, unless we're reading, because it does sometimes happen where the text has been...
I think it can be. It's open to interpretation, because there is this talk of the sex maniacs and stuff like that. But I didn't read it into it.
Okay, that's good. I suddenly thought, am I reading a different book? Is this different text? But I didn't get it at all. Maybe we're just savage British people who are not sensitive enough to this sort of thing.
Well, you certainly are, Bina, definitely.
Okay, let's get into the adaptations. So there are two. There's a film starring Peter Ustinov and Jean Stapleton.
Which I really wanted to watch, but I cannot get hold of for love nor money.
Same here. And I did my usual digging around on YouTube, because a lot of these old Ustinovs, admittedly in crappy quality, you can get there, or Amazon Prime Video sometimes has these really old ones, but I couldn't find it either. So if anyone knows where we can watch this 1986 version, because All About Agatha watched it.
Yeah, dust off your DVD player and try and buy an old copy off eBay. I think that's the only way we're going to get hold of it. So.
I agree. Well, I might have a little route on. I don't have a DVD player, but I'm sure I can work something out. Okay, so then the one that you can more easily watch is the David C. Shea Agatha Christie's Poirot, as I said before, filmed in the actual Greenway, which makes it particularly lovely. It stars Sean Pertwee as Sir George Stubbs, Sinead Cusack, the amazing Sinead Cusack, as Amy Folliat, Rebecca Front, for all you Thick of It fans, as Amanda Brewis, who else is in there? Zoe Wanamaker as Ariadne Oliver. I think she's marvellous in that role. It was the last episode of the series to be filmed, although not the last to air. So it must have been very meaningful and beautiful to film. So there are some changes, but it's broadly speaking faithful to the novel. And I really like this. I thought it was very lusciously filmed. Like, it's Greenway looks gorgeous. It's filmed in high summer, and the costumes are particularly lovely, like the ones that Ariadne Oliver wears. So I quite liked it. What did you think? If you've watched it,
I enjoyed it. I suppose there's an element of indulgence there, but I did think you mentioned Sinead Cusack. I thought she was outstanding as Amy Follier, and yes, I thought Zoe Wanamaker. I wouldn't say she played it for laughs, but I thought her Ariadne Oliver was just on point. You know, she got all the comic lines, the bit where they're talking about the intuition, you know, all that sort of stuff was just delivered just the way I thought it should be. And then there's a scene where in the orchard and she's scattering apples, you know, and you're like, this is the Ariadne Oliver that we know. So I thought it was well done.
Yeah, I completely agree. Well worth watching, and the last of an epic series, so almost worth watching just for that. At that point, I think we'll take a little bit of a pause. We have done our spoiler-free discussion, ladies and gentlemen, and you can join us next time for what will probably be a mini-pod on 450 from Paddington, which is a Miss Marple novel. In the meantime, thank you very much for listening, and stay tuned after the end credits music for a discussion of the solution to this novel. Okay, folks, we are back with the clues and the solution to this novel. I guess my first question, Pat, is this, did you manage to deduce the outcome?
No, and I think that's one of the reasons why I rank this as highly as I do, because I think if it hadn't been, if it hadn't had, because I was quite shocked when you sort of like you get it explained to you by Poirot. I'd been completely blindsided. Mm. It's the classic murder mystery where you suddenly you look back as he's explaining it to you, going, miss that clue, miss that clue, miss that clue. I thought that's why I think this is such a strong strong Christie. You know, I'd never got it. What about you? I mean, I suppose this is a reread for you. So
yeah, but I sort of vaguely remembered how it worked, but even on the second read, because it'd been so long ago, like over 20 years since I'd read it, I didn't get it. And I think it's beautifully plotted. I think everything makes total sense. And what annoys me about not getting it is the actual title of the book is a giveaway. Mm-hmm. When you know, like, it is Dead Man's Folly. It's a folly built in a stupid place that doesn't have a view, because it's covering a dead person. And it's like, you're just like, oh, Agatha, you wily, wily woman.
Yeah.
Still got it. It's you're in your mid-60s and you can still absolutely do it. I think it's brilliantly plotted. I really do think so.
Yeah, and I do think, like, one of the strengths, which, again, like, if you have a look at some of the reviews of the time, and I'm not even sure that they even acknowledge it on the All About Agatha podcast, is she does clue this really well. I mean, like, we'll get into explaining it, but, like, the way that I didn't find Michael Wayman a very sympathetic character. And I didn't find the jealous secretary, whose name I've forgotten at the moment.
Evis, you know, or Brevis, yeah.
They're telling us what's going on, but I'm dismissing them as characters because, you know, I don't like them.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, they've been portrayed unsympathetically, but they're telling us exactly what's happened. You know,
and you dismiss the ferryman because he's gothic, and Marlene because she's a gossiping schoolgirl, and you dismiss the kind of the evidence of the backpackers because you just think, oh, Hercule Poirot doesn't like naked young bodies.
Yeah.
There's so much hiding in plain sight. It's just brilliant, I think. Okay, so let's get into the clues. And I'm going to do them in a slightly sort of an order of grouping that I think makes sense to then get you to the solution. So the first big clue is the ferryman basically saying there will always be Folliots at Nass House. Take it seriously. The fact that Marlene's granddad saw a disappearing body in the woods, so that conversation about sex crimes. So there are sex crimes about here. At least my granddad saw a body and then it disappeared. Everything being engineered to have Marlene play the body in the boathouse, not in the folly, which is where Ariadne Oliver initially wanted the murder to be discovered. The fact that the folly itself is in a rather odd place, as the architect points to. The fact that the grandfather is the third murder victim, if you assume Hattie's the second.
Yeah.
So that all leads you back to the Tucker family and the fact that her little sister says she's a big gossip and she has more money for lipsticks and things than you might expect. certain that the granddad knows a lot. And then when we get inside Nat's house, the fact that Hattie does wear extravagant makeup and hats, so almost a disguise in plain sight. George's theatrical beard and sort of, you know, apparent naval career and money. The fact that George goes from, this is more of a micro clue now, the fact that George goes from scolding the morning backpackers to being super nice to them in the afternoon, that's a bit of a tell. So those are all the main clues, I think. Have you got any others? And the fact that Hattie does a bunk when the one person who would know what the real Hattie probably looks like is about to arrive in Etienne de Souza, yeah. I suppose.
Yeah, and when Etienne's questions and he explains that he'd written to them a few weeks ago, you know, and they're saying that they only received notice of it on that day. There was a quote from Michael Wayman, and again, it was like the folly being built in the wrong place. But I also thought it worked on a sort of a meta level to show that, like, Nat's house was rotten. He just said, "These tycoons," said the latter bitterly, "can't understand first principles." And he delivered a final kick to the lopsided folly. "If the foundations are rotten, everything's rotten."
Yeah.
And then Poirot's like, "It is profound what you say there," said Poirot. "Yes, it is profound." You know, and she's done that quite a way through the book. You know, she drops these little passages in and you sort of like skip over them. And, you know, you go, "That's Poirot being Poirot." But like, you know, you should, like, if you are taking this book seriously to try and solve it, these are the sort of clues that she's dropped in, you know, for you to pick up on. And like, I got none of them, I don't think, you know.
No, I
think
I didn't.
The only thing that tipped me off was that what's his name, George Stubbs, just seems very over the top. And again,
playing comes across
as not as a nice character, because this young girl's been murdered and he's going, "But my wife's gone missing. We've got to find my wife." And I did think that was a bit over the top. But again, you know, I dismissed it just thinking he's just not a nice guy. So.
So let's get into the solution to this novel. And again, sort of going a little bit more in order than how it appears in the book. So Mrs. Folliat's younger, disreputable Monty son was a deserter and did not, in fact, die in the war. Myrtle, the old boatman, recognises the fact that George Stubbs is, in fact, this Folliat son in disguise.
Agatha Christie's brother, Monty. Yeah.
I feel so sorry for Monty. Maybe he was a nice guy and we just keep on besmirching his character by linking him with all these disreputable ne'er-do-wells.
Yeah, I think she writes variations of Monty. Sometimes they are a lot more sympathetic than other times.
Yeah, sometimes they get redeemed by the love of good women, but this is not the case. So actually, George Stubbs, a.k.a. Junior Folliat, has no real money. Hattie was not a pauper, as Amy Folliat suggests, but was actually rich. And so Amy Folliat marries this poor, simple, but very rich girl to her quote-unquote son, so that he will have the money to maintain Folliat House. So in cold blood, Amy Folliat uses poor young Hattie, who's her ward. The problem is, and I guess Amy Folliat did not know this at the time, that George was a bigamist because he was already married to an Italian wife when he then married Hattie. So what happened is he killed the real Hattie, which is the body that Myrtle saw in the woods and then didn't see, and had her buried under the folly that he built in the rather odd place, and brought his Italian wife into Nat's house to play Hattie. And the idea was in time that Hattie would go and then he would marry his real Italian wife, or just live with the Italian wife as Hattie, I guess, if she wasn't exposed. Mm. But the problem is that Myrtle's been talking to his granddaughter, and his granddaughter's a bit of a snoop, and she's been blackmailing George, or tried to blackmail George. So she had to be killed. And, you know, the opportunity came with a visiting cousin who could expose the truth that, you know, okay, let's have the summer fete at the house and let's get it done there.
Mm. I got the feeling as well that visiting cousin was also a problem, because they were like sure that he would spot straight away that.
So either Hattie had to go, or maybe they would pin the murder on the visiting cousin, or maybe murder him too, who knows. But events were, you know, they had to take, because of the blackmail and the visiting cousin, they had to take action, basically, this husband and wife team. And that's why Sir George wanted his horrible folly built with concrete foundations in a place with no view, basically. And his wife has basically taken off her ridiculous makeup and outfit and dressed herself as a backpacker and snuck out the window, which is why she literally vanishes into thin air. So it's a bit similar to Taken at the Flood, insofar as you have a sort of a fake wife who's impersonating.
Yeah, well, I put that down. There's a couple of books I wanted to contrast this with. I've already mentioned The Hollow,
yes.
But then Taken at the Flood, because I thought, like, this again, it's almost like a mirror image of Taken by the Flood, because I felt this was an average book that was redeemed by its ending, whereas Taken by the Flood is a good book which is ruined by its ending. What I thought this reminded me of was Evil Under the Sun, because I think that Christie has taken that dynamic from Evil Under the Sun and she's just given us another flavor of it here. And it's almost like this is Evil Under the Sun, but the couple who have committed the murder have got away with it for just a little bit longer. You know, they've not been caught straight away. And it made me wonder, because I really didn't like this Lord Stubbs character. Like I mentioned this when we did the Evil Under the Sun podcast. Like, I think that the criminals in that, the murderers in that, were two of Christie's nastiest villains.
Yes.
And I'm not sure that they're at the same level. But I think these are quite nasty people, and I think, like, in some of the books that she's written, you feel more sympathy for the criminals than you do in this one. In this one, you're like, these people are thoroughly nasty, you know, horrible, you know, murderous, you know, like they have absolutely no sort of redeeming aspect to it, you know.
Yeah.
And the fact that they've decided to kill this young teenage girl.
It's horrible. You know,
it really, really terrible.
And the one I think is even worse is Amy Folliat, because
she
falls in with it and she should know better. And I think it is interesting that Poirot just sort of gives her the chance to slink off and basically commit suicide. But I wonder if that's an easy ending for her, because she, to me, like, George Stubbs, aka the son, has always been a ne'er-do-well and just did it for the cash, as probably did the wife who loves the jewellery. They're just mercenaries.
Well, there is, but there's that... It's a beautifully written passage towards the end. And I do think that's one of the reasons why this book ends so gracefully compared to some of the other ones, because Christie hasn't felt the need to spell out in detail, you know, to cross the T's and dot the I's with exactly what's going to happen to everybody. She leaves us this open-ended, ambiguous, you know, end where we don't know what happens to the criminals, you know, but the assumption is now Poirot solved that they're all going to get justice in some form. But Amy Folliat, she has this statement to Poirot where she's basically admitting it. Poirot's cornered her and explained to her that they're digging up the folly. And she says about James, her son, "Even as a child, he frightened me, merciless, without pity, without conscience.
Yeah.
He was my son and I loved him. Oh, I should have spoken out after Hattie's death, but he was my son. How could I be the one to give him up? And so, because of my silence, that poor silly child was killed. And after her, dear old Myrtle, where would it have ended?" And it's tragic reading that. And like, but you're right. Amy Folliat is an accomplice in these murders, you know, and she has facilitated what her son has done. Because he is the real criminal.
Because, I mean, she implies he's almost like a psycho or sociopath, right? Because
he's
been like that since birth, but she hasn't.
Yeah.
But she's there
saying, look, well, I have tremendous sympathy for her, because she's not done the right thing, but that's because it's her son. It's her flesh and blood.
And it's her son in the wake of a war where she's lost another son and just lost her husband.
Yeah.
So I
find it tragic in a way.
I think it is moving for, like you said, the characters, I don't find myself that invested in them. But actually, by the end, Amy Folliat, I thought, was really fascinating as a sort of an accomplice to murder. And maybe the fact that Poirot/Christie allows her to exit stage left and not be taken to the police shows that sympathy.
I think it's a strength. You can read this any way. I mean, I certainly got the impression when I read it, although it wasn't spelled out, that she was probably going to take her own life.
Yes,
and
very
that
much
would
so.
Be the way that justice would be served, and that Poirot is quite happy with that. You know,
and they say that explicitly in novels, don't they? Like, you hear the gunshots, so they make that very explicit. Yeah.
But I think you, like, you know, it's open. If you want to see that the police arrest them or whatever, you can read that into it as well if you want to.
Mm.
But like, so it's there, and I don't think it needs to be detailed. doesn't need to have the ending of Taken at the Flood, where, you know, it just gets dragged out that little bit too far, you know, and destroyed. So I thought this was well done, this one, this ending.
I agree. Well, listener, we hope you've enjoyed our discussion of this top of middle tier, Christy. I think it's one of the very strongest of the late sort of Hercule Poirot novels for plotting. I really do. Really captivating read. So thank you, Pat, for coming on and discussing it with me. And stay tuned, listener, for next time's podcast, which will be 4:50 from Paddington. In the meantime, feel free to leave a comment on the YouTube channel, jump on the Discord where we can take the discussion further and indeed discuss all manner of things. Otherwise, thank you for listening. Thank you.